Welcome to PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr., crime analyst on A&E Network's police documentary show, Live PD. If you watch Live PD, you're going to know the person I'm interviewing today on PD Stories. It's Sergeant Denver Leverett of the Jeffersonville, Indiana Police Department. While many might know Sergeant Leverett and his canine partner, Flex, from watching the show, today we're going to learn about other dogs that have been by Leverett's side in his career and how one saved his life. And he's going to give us insight into how he became the human lie detector.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Now, what made you decide to go into law enforcement?
My decision was based off several factors. My father is a retired firefighter. My uncle is a retired police chief, so public service was in my blood. But it actually hit me personally. My best friend was murdered during a drug deal in 2001. In addition, I've had several family members, aunts, and cousins that have suffered from drug addiction resulting in death. So I developed a passion for interdiction, narcotics, doing this type of drug work, and it's, you know, continued the fire 18 years later.
And, you know, I've watched you on the show for many months, and I had no idea. I didn't know any of that backstory there. What year did you become an officer?
The very beginning, 2001. I graduated from Indiana University in 99 with my degree in criminal justice, and then I applied and was hired at the beginning of 01.
What was the academy experience like?
It was military-like. It was a lot different than college, and it instilled discipline. I had that growing up, but it was a very good experience. It was 12 weeks long, and basically received the classroom part in addition to the physical aspect of it. But it was a very good experience, and a lot of good memories and friends met there.
Do you remember your first day on the street?
I do. I was in field training and actually got in a foot pursuit. Still remember it like it was yesterday.
On your first day on the job?
On my first night. And I was like a fish out of water. I didn't know what I was doing, but just tried to maintain my composure. And you don't necessarily have that fear then, the first day on the job. But like I said, 18 years later, married with a 2.5-year-old now, it's like, you know, this is a deadly occupation.
Did you catch him?
Yes, we did. We did. Thankfully, I had some assistance, but realized kind of how out of shape I was at that point.
Any other highlight memories from your rookie year?
Not necessarily from my rookie year, but soon thereafter, they had a vacancy in the canine unit, and that's always been my passion. Nobody applied for it. And about a year into the job, I applied for it. I was the only candidate, and the chief pulled me aside and said, you know, we have a 2-year minimum requisite to get into the unit. So if I put you in, there's no you getting out. And I gave him my word, still honor that 18 years later. And I was almost killed during a traffic stop with two individuals where a guy tried to grab my gun and I had to use the door pop on my belt and my dog saved my life. So it was a lot of scary incidences within the first year or two of law enforcement. And it just seems to steadily get worse.
There's a lot of responsibility that comes with being a canine officer, right?
Yes, you're typically the first one through the door. And, you know, he is a tool of law enforcement. He's not perfect, but he's very good at what he does. But you're always the first one called upon. And the way I look at it is I have to put the training into it because I have other officers' lives at risk. And I need to make sure that they go home at night to their families. So there's a lot invested in Canine Flex and his training.
We love watching Canine Flex work on Live PD. How old is Flex?
He is 5.5 years old, and I've had him 4.5 years. He's a Dutch Shepherd. He's a Brindle. And he's actually my fourth canine.
The first time you came to New York with him, he was just an immediate hit when people saw him in the studio with us. He's just really, really intense when he's in a vehicle searching and he you know, hits on and indicates. And how long did it take to train him to be that type of canine?
So when we get our canines, they're what you call green dogs. They have a ball drive and a bite drive. And then when we train them to get them to the minimum standards to pass the test, I would say approximately 3 months, 5 days a week, maybe a couple hours a day. And what you see in Canine Flex, it's my belief that it all goes down leash, is what we say as canine handlers. I'm a very OCD, anal, type A personality. In my job, I strive for perfection. And when I train him, I try to implement into him. That's maybe one of my downfalls, but I think it shows in his performance, and you know, I take pride in that.
Explain what it means to be a dual-purpose canine.
So a dual-purpose canine is one aspect is narcotics, and he's a passive alert narcotic detection dog, which means he alerts on the odors of marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamine, and heroin. And then his other aspect of law enforcement is criminal apprehension. So he does bite only when he's commanded to do so, except for one scenario, and that is handler protection. So if I have him out of the vehicle and maybe I'm patting down numerous subjects, but if one of them hits me, he will engage the suspect without being instructed to do so.
Really?
And they're a bite and hold canine, and then we have to do everything off lead with verbal commands only, so I can tell him to disengage with just one command, and he will comply.
Can you explain the ball and bite drive as far as the training for canine goes?
So when I say ball drive, every canine has their own, what we call the substitute for their prey article. I use the tennis ball for his narcotics, and this is his drive satisfaction for his hunt drive. So we use the tennis ball during the narcotics, and then when I talk about his prey drive, his hunt instinct, that's more directed towards criminal apprehension, the man. So there's two different aspects when I talk about the dual purpose aspect of canine.
Now, that particular training, the criminal apprehension training, mm-hmm. that's a specific another set of lessons that you have to teach over a period of time. How long does it take to get him trained to that level of criminal apprehension efficiency?
So, like when I get him from overseas and he came from Holland, he's a Dutch Shepherd, like I said, he has what we call a bite drive. So he will bite the bite sleeve. We incorporate the bite suit, which then leads into the hidden sleeve during training. And then the last facet of aggression control is what we call it during training is muzzle work. That's where you take out all of the equipment and it's just man against him. And, you know, when I talk about this 3 months, numerous hours a day, 5 days a week, that's just to the bare minimum standards to certify him. And then after that, we have to do scenario-based training. So his last two apprehensions were actually in attics of residences with individuals that were wanted on felony charges that wouldn't comply. And we have an attic deployment system, and you know, if you never train that, you can't expect a canine to perform it. But I've been blessed with him. We do train it, and he's performed remarkably.
Now, when you sent him into the attic, he goes up there by himself, into the attic alone, or are you right behind him?
So what we do is we have an attic deployment system, and he is actually in a harness. And I have a pulley system with ropes, and we shimmy him up into the attic, and we have a rip cord that we pull. Then he drops into the rafters, and he will actually search the attic. I'll stay in the room below, and then when he gets in human odor, he will bark if he can't get to the suspect, but if he can, then he will bite and hold. So what I like to do is, for safety reasons, I'll have him clear the immediate area and then deploy him down the length of a house, and then I'll go up, and everything's done off lead. And it's actually an attic. It's a very hard scenario because of the odor. You have the insulation. It doesn't breathe well. It's very hot. There's wires and wood, and It's a tactical nightmare.
Does he have his own Twitter handle now, I think?
Well, actually, I don't do any social media. I was inundated with it. But my mother, his grandmother, actually is responsible for his account. And he is the most social canine I've had out of the four. He's very good with my 2.5-year-old son. And at home, even in the studio, you look at him and you wouldn't think he's a dual-purpose canine. So he also does criminal apprehension. And he's so social and mild-mannered, but, you know, at a light switch, he'll do his job, and he's really made a difference in my career.
Everyone who's watched you do your job in Jeffersonville on Live PD knows one thing about Sergeant Denver Leverett, that you are a master field inquisitor of the people that you pull over. You
right.
have an ability to almost Jedi mind trick people into admitting that they've got heroin hidden when they were really denying it. Explain your interview questioning style.
You know, some people say it's trickery. I don't believe in that. This is all I do is interdiction work. And the main aspect of interdiction is the art of conversation. And what I find is when you're talking to someone, if you treat them as an individual and equal, you don't talk down to them or belittle them, and you set the gun and the badge aside, people, if you keep them talking, you don't let them think, and you stay persistent, you can get them to crack, and they'll incriminate themselves. And you saw the incidents on the show where the guy said, monkey can't sell bananas, and after they admit to dealing methamphetamine and post-Miranda warning, they're like, why did I just say that? And it's all how you talk to people, and you have to stay persistent. That's the key.
My favorite encounter that I watched you do was a lady who kept lying and lying, mm-hmm. and you knew she had heroin the whole time. And eventually, you got her to the point where she told you, I think you said, let me guess, it's in your bra.
Right.
And then you said, let me guess which side, left side. And you were right. And we were just like, whoa, he's a savant. I mean, my God, how did you know this?
And part of that was luck. If, based off my training and experience, if a female is going to conceal narcotics, it's going to be one of two places. So there's a 50% chance I'm going to get it right on which place. So I guessed right. But what a lot of people didn't pick up on is while I'm talking to this female and she's retrieving her documents, she's handing it to me with her right hand. So I assume that she's right-handed, dominant. So if she's going to conceal something on her body in her bra, she's going to use her right hand, which is going to go to her left side.
Wow.
So then I just guessed at that side. So it was luck, but based off some indicators is what we say when I'm speaking to her in conversation, those are a couple things that I picked up on.
That's really interesting. Speaking of narcotics, we've seen a lot of overdoses in Jeffersonville and the other jurisdictions that we're covering and following around the country on Live PD. When did it really start to get this bad that you began to realize it?
I would say my first 10 years of law enforcement, I never saw meth or heroin. This last 7-8 years, it's all I see. I do all narcotics, and I also do cases on a federal level, and you can now purchase an ounce of methamphetamine for cheaper than you can purchase high-grade marijuana, an ounce of marijuana.
And really?
If I had to guesstimate, now, of course, I target certain areas of town that have high crime rates, and I focus on a lot of indicators, but I would say 7 out of the 10 cars I stop are either going to have a meth pipe, a syringe, meth, or heroin. And it's an epidemic now. It's sad. And like I said, I've had my own family members suffer from this addiction. It's a deadly addiction. And, you know, I continue to fight the battle and do my part because at the end of the day, the ones who suffer the most are the kids. And the calls where I go on and mother and father are overdosed in the vehicle and the kids are in the car seat, vehicle not running, it's 80 degrees outside and they're sweating. It breaks my heart, and I try to do everything I can to make a difference in their life and to help them. And, you know, and there's another thing when you see me on the show, I try not to lock up everybody I come in contact with.
I've noticed that, yes.
Because the individuals that are possessing drugs, they have an addiction, and if I can help them out and get them treatment and solve the issue in another way, then I try to do that to keep the family structure together. But it's a battle that we fight on a daily basis.
Live PD viewers are always fascinated by how many people are pulled over that do not have a license, do not have insurance, do not have any documentation even as to who they are.
And that's going back to the criminal indicators that we focus on during traffic stops. If I ask for a driver's license or photo identification and they don't have one, there's my first red flag. Okay, when I attempt to identify them and they don't know their social security number, there's a second red flag. If they're on probation or parole, there's a third red flag. So when I'm speaking to individuals in conversation, trying to identify them, I'm looking at eye contact, breathing rates, whether they're perspiring or not. And when they don't know who they are, or if you see me sometimes, and then I'll go back to how much, you know, do you weigh, and I'll jump around. And if their age doesn't match their date of birth given, then I know they're lying. And you just got to keep people talking. You got to keep them rolling. And that's the most difficult thing, is trying to identify people sometimes, because they'll memorize other people's date of births, and they may have a twin brother, and that's half the battle, is identifying somebody. There's some people you'll stop and you'll ask them, you know, do you have any heroin in the car? No. Any methamphetamine? No. Any cocaine? Cocaine. And their skin will just go pale white. And they'll look to the glove box. Well, that's where the dope's at. They look like they're going to faint. I've had some people actually throw up on the side of the road. They get so nervous. You know, you're going to get decent at what you do, but this is all I do. You know, they kid me at work and they say, you couldn't find a drunk in a bar. And I'm like, yeah, you're right, but that's not my passion. My passion is narcotics work, and that's what I love to train to do. And, you know, but it hits me personally.
Police work on a daily basis is an exercise in expecting the unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
What is the most bizarre thing that you've seen?
Oh, man. I would say some of the places that I have found narcotics to be concealed, and I'll let your imagination go to work, but
the personal locker?
Yeah, the personal locker, or the jail locker, as we call it. And I'll even tell them, I'm like, look, if you take this into the jail, you're subject to being charged with trafficking with an inmate. We have a body scanner down there. Nope, don't have anything. And we'll get all the way to a strip search based off policy. Don't have anything on me. And male subjects will, you know, put it in body cavities that... And it's like, oh man, how can you do that? Just give it up. But the worst part is, when I think about it, is they remove it from that body cavity before every drug deal to sell to somebody. So that person that's buying it, I mean, just
Well, inside prison, they don't care how
the drugs get
in there.
They just don't want to be caught.
Yeah. We see so many people that are pulled over in traffic stops, and they don't have a license because they've already gotten tickets they could not pay. And as an officer, you do see people sometimes that, you know, this person is economically disadvantaged.
Sure.
They're a single mom with three kids in the back, and she's working as a waitress in a restaurant, and a $400 ticket is more than maybe 2 weeks' salary for her.
Do you ever take those things into consideration when you're dealing with people?
We never police for profit. We don't have any quotas. And if you review all of the videotapes, I never write tickets unless I arrest you and I have to document the reason why I stopped you for the criminal arrest. The way I look at it is I'm going to look at how you treat me. So as long as you're treating me with respect and
not endangering the public.
Yeah, not endangering the public, and I can give you a verbal warning. Why not do that? Typically, when you write somebody a ticket and it's a $100, $200 fine just to write it, you could now escalate the situation verbally to maybe into an incident to where you may have to use force. And I don't want to do that. You know, talk to them, tell them what they did wrong, and try to educate them, you know, about the dangers of speeding or not using their turn signal. Give them a verbal warning. And this is all based on community policing. And if I can develop a stronger bond with the community, in addition to the minority population, my wife is a minority. And if I can strengthen that relationship with the minority population, bring us together, then that is better than writing somebody a ticket and causing friction to the situation. I would rather build the bond and gain their trust, because that person that you stopped for failing to signal a lane change, if you decide to write them a ticket, now they could be adversarial, but if you don't and you're you know, nice with them and give them a verbal warning, they may be that witness to an armed robbery or a homicide 5 years down the road. And they may think back, you know what, you never wrote me a ticket. I have information on this crime and you treated me with respect. And now I'm going to treat you with respect. I try to look at the big picture.
What's the scariest situation you've encountered on the job?
It's all canine related. I've been the first through the door, and I've almost been killed three times. I've had two guys pull a gun on me, and then the one incident where the guy tried to take my gun.
What happened there?
Well, the one where I did a traffic stop, he was intoxicated. There was two occupants inside the vehicle. I was by myself, and I'm not a very imposing individual. And when he got out of the car, I told him to get back in the car. He wouldn't. He kept walking towards me. I didn't have any backup.
Did you have a taser?
No, we didn't have tasers at this time. This was back in 01, 02. We had pepper spray, but it happened so quick that I was able to get him up against a vehicle while I'm still trying to see the occupant. He then reaches for my gun. We didn't have double retention holsters at that point. And as he was pulling the gun out of my holster, I was able to get him on the ground. Couldn't get him handcuffed. Hit the door pop because the other guy got out of the car and it was going to be two on one.
And the door pop opened your vehicle so flex so your canine can jump out.
At that point, it was a canine Dutch, and he was a Dutch Shepherd, and came out. And that guy ended up taking off running, and canine Dutch engaged the driver. And then I separated myself to take a cover position and waited for backup and, you know, was thankful. The second incident, just to, you know, speak on that, is it was a burglary at a pharmacy, and the guy was armed with a handgun waiting under a desk for me and had the gun in between his knees, and I never saw him. Canine came around, engaged him because he's a bite and hold canine. And when he pulled him out of the desk, I saw the gun and I was a foot or two away from him. Didn't have time to pull my gun out. The only thing I could do was go hands on with him and disarm him. And incidences like that, the first thing that goes through your mind is your wife and your children. And you got to go home that night.
I know from being in situations out there when I was an officer that you're not afraid until after something's over.
Right. Your adrenaline kicks in.
Yeah. When you're in the moment and you're dealing with a tense situation, you're not afraid. You're just focused.
Right. You have that adrenaline dump, and the only thing that gets you through those situations, honestly, is your training and the muscle memory, the repetition that you went through during your training. And you know, if anybody ever tells you that you never get scared doing this job, they're lying to you. Mm-hmm. You know, I get scared all the time. Mm-hmm. That's what keeps me tactical. Mm-hmm. I try to use conversation and my verbal skills to de-escalate situations, but there's sometimes when people, they don't want to hear it. They're not going to do what you say. And while you're going through these situations, a lot of times you get tunnel vision. You can't hear things. And you have to rely on your training, your experience. And this is what's helped me through these situations. You know, some people may not realize that when you have an armed individual, they want to think that you can aim at the weapon, but you're just trained on center mass. And a lot of officers that are involved in shootings, they don't know how many times they fire their weapon. That's what I talk about, that tunnel vision, that there's something that comes over your body physiologically that it's survival. That's all it is. It's survival.
It's important to state in shape, mm-hmm. and to train.
Sure.
I worked with a lot of officers who only went to the range when it was time for their annual qualification or recertification. And I would always say to them, you're carrying a weapon out here every single mm-hmm. day, and you're telling me that you actually only go to the range once a year.
And you can shoot a paper all day, which is the paper target. But when you're in a real life situation and you have to rely on muscle memory, you don't see your sights. It's just, you don't even see the weapon, and you have to put in more than that is the minimum requirement to hit on your point. And thankfully, my administration provides a lot of extensive training. They're there to help us, support us, and you know, they're policemen at heart. And it feels good working for a chief and administration as the ones that I do have.
What do you love most about your job as a police officer?
Well, you never get in it for the money. What I get out of it, I really like the interaction with the children and making a positive impact on them. I take my canine Flex to a lot of schools, do a lot of demos, a lot of community outreach, policing, community policing, and just the PR engagement. And this show and Big Fish Entertainment, they've really...
Live PD.
Yeah, Live PD. They've really opened my eyes, and they've made that bond a lot more possible, and that's what I get most out of. You're always going to have drug dealers. You can always lock drug dealers up and criminals, but when you can really divulge into the community policing aspect of it, that's the most rewarding to me.
Well, Sergeant Denver Leverett, thank you for joining us on PD Stories. It's been a pleasure to have you. Give Flex a pet and a doggy treat for me.
He's on vacation today. He's waiting for me to get back.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for PD Stories. I'm your host, Tom Morris Jr. Don't forget to watch me every Friday and Saturday night on Live PD on A&E at 9 o'clock. PD Stories is an A&E production produced in association with Audio Boom. PD Stories is executive produced and created by Sue Funk for A&E Networks.